You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Hello, and welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back British paranormal investigator Ruth Roper Wild to the show. Within hours of Ruth's last appearance, back on episode 91, I had emails and messages asking me when she'd be returning. As such, since her last appearance, Ruth has released the second volume of These Haunted Times, which collects another compendium of first-hand witness accounts from all over the United Kingdom. We discuss some of the spooky tales in the book, from a couple of very different ghosts that seem to inhabit a property in Anglesey, Wales, a rather unnerving experience from Her Majesty's Prison Lewes, a whole cavalcade of events that affect several properties in Blandford Forum, Dorset, a rather chilling tale involving a poltergeist from Birmingham, a spectral monk on an airbase, some more haunted roads, and much more besides. As always, it was a real pleasure, and a big thank you for Ruth for joining me again on this week's show. As always, you can support the show for $4 a month by signing up for our Patreon, and the link will be in the show notes. You'll get early access to the regular show, bonus episodes, and prize draws, so sign up today. We're also across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can still support the show by subscribing to the channel on YouTube as well. As always, the artwork for this week's show is by Dean Bestel. The show is produced, as always, by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let's sit back, draw the curtains, and take a spooky tour of the United Kingdom in the company of Ruth Roper Wild. On Mysteries and Monsters this week, it's a warm welcome back to author Ruth Roper Wild, with her latest book, These Haunted Times, Volume 2, being released just before Christmas. Ruth is continuing to uncover modern encounters from around the British Isles. Ruth, welcome back.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be back. Hi.
Oh, how are we?
Well, you know, surviving in these difficult times, keeping busy.
Absolutely. How are you? Yes, the same here. And it's times like this I'm very glad I've got this hobby.
Do you know, at times like this, it really is quite handy to have something that can really engage your mind and give you something to think about other than the problems in the world, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's nice to switch off and do something that gives us a bit of enjoyment without any sort of stress, I think.
It really is, and I can easily lose a few hours getting down rabbit holes when I'm doing the research, so...
Yeah, very much so. So, firstly, thank you so much for coming back. I had such a positive response when you appeared. It doesn't seem that long ago, but it was about 4 months ago. It was prior to Halloween.
Unbelievable. It seems like just a few weeks ago, honestly.
Yeah. So, I had a lot of people really hoping you'd be back, and I've been teasing them and saying, well, hopefully Ruth will be back, knowing full well that I'd arranged for you to return.
So, you too.
Well, you've got to build it up somehow. So in regards to this then, Ruth, as we were discussing, you were just about to complete and release your second volume of These Haunted Times. So how's the response been, and how's it been going since the book came out just before Christmas?
Absolutely great. Yeah, really, really pleased. It's selling well, which is always good for an author. But better still, I'm getting a lot of people contacting me with yet more stories, which is always my idea of the best part of the fun, is when people contact saying, loved reading that, want to tell you about my ghost. And it's had, you know, quite a few sales around the world and quite a few comments from around the world. So really, really pleased with how it's going so far. Seems to have landed quite well.
Excellent. I mean, it is, for me, as I said the first time we spoke, Ruth, I think it's really nice for someone to finally start collecting modern ghost stories that seem to come from that tradition of Peter Underwood and John and Anne Spencer and that type of thing, where we have, I wouldn't, not disrespectfully meaning in regards to some of these reports, but a lot of these stories are quite mundane, normal hauntings where people just want to share them, and it makes a real refreshing change to read a collection of stories where nobody's being... I mean, there are obviously a few scary stories in the book, but on the whole, these are quite normal ghost stories in the scheme of things.
Well, I think this is why, for me, this is why I wanted to do it this way. Mm. Because there are two reasons I really got into writing myself about ghosts. One was because I was fed up of seeing the same old story churned out again and again and again, just kind of repeated by different authors or magazines or articles or whatever, without anybody ever checking whether that ghost was still there or not. And I wanted to check whether the ghost was still there or not. But also, I wanted to self-publish, which I do. I'm an independent author. Because I was really worried that if I went to, and I might be being very unfair to publishing houses, but I was very worried that with how sort of excitable some of the ghost programs that you see on television can get, you know, with demonic attacks and having to do cleanses and what have you because things have got completely out of hands and families are terrified. Mm. And you start to wonder whether they're being hyped up and sexed up a bit, if you like, to make it more scary than it is. Mm. And I wanted to present the absolute truth. So with my books, if somebody tells me I lived in a really haunted house and I say to them, oh, what happened? And they say, well, we were sitting at dinner one night and the door slammed. That's what I'm going to write about, that the door slammed. Hmm. I'm not going to try and sex that up into they have an evil ghost who has terrified the family for years and a dark presence. And, you know, I'm not going to use all that flowery language to describe something that just happened as part of their normal daily thing that they wanted to write me about. Mm. Because in my experience, that's what the paranormal is like. You can, even if you live in a really haunted property, you know, that's known to be very active, you can go months and months with nothing happening, and then you'll have a little spate of it or whatever. It's not normally this constant round of terror and sort of very Amityville horror type film, you know, that you kind of think of sometimes. Mm. It's much more mundane and normal that you'll be going about your ordinary daily things and something inexplicable will happen. Yeah. And that, to me, is the true paranormal that most people experience. It's not to say that there aren't sometimes some very terrifying things, because there genuinely are. But the majority are kind of woven into the fabric of daily life, of small, individual little incidents, and it's only when you start to put them together that you think, my God, I've got a bit of a pattern going on here, you know, with this place I'm living in and whatever. And quite often people just carry on with their day after whatever it was happened with just this sort of vague, puzzled feeling that I can't explain what that was that just happened. Mm. Not this feeling of absolute terror that you kind of imagine that you might get if you start talking about the paranormal, you know?
Yeah. I mean, obviously there are some chilling encounters in the book, but there are a lot of those kind of stories where things just disappear for a few weeks and reappear in odd places. I think there's one story that mentions passports going for a wander and then they just reappear in the drawer that they've checked countless times. And I like stories like that because it always seems to show a bit of mischievousness on behalf of whatever's involved in this. And I do like a ghost with a sense of humour.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because certain types of paranormal activity do seem to have, like you say, a sort of mischievous element to them. Mm. And sometimes those mischievous ones can turn slightly darker and become a bit more threatening. And that makes you wonder whether there's some kind of entity behind that, as opposed to the spirit of a dead person, you know, the sort of classical definition of a ghost. Mm. And it makes you wonder whether there's different types of entity and different types of paranormal occurrence, which, if somebody pushed me into a corner to try and say, what do I believe in? I think I would actually go more along the lines of, I think there's going to be more than one explanation. Mm. For exactly that reason, that some things seem to have a certain amount of intelligence to what's going on. Mm. And intelligence tends to suggest some sort of entity. Mm. So it does make you wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I had a very interesting conversation recently with an American ghost hunter, Kitsy Duncan, and we touched on a thought that perhaps in some of these situations, some of these entities or disembodied spirits or ghosts or whatever label you want to put on them, Ruth, some of them are probably just quite lonely and looking for some attention.
Well, do you know, that's always possible, isn't it? Mm. And actually, even as you were saying that, it struck a thought in my head that actually some people in life are mischievous and like to play pranks. So perhaps it's just the case that they remain that way in Afterlife. You know, it's also fascinating that when you get talking about it like this and you start to think, actually, that could work. That is a possible explanation. One day somebody will figure it all out for us and we'll know the answer.
Absolutely, because I would imagine if that's one of the facets of your personality in life, I find it very hard to believe that if that carries on in whatever form it may be, surely that would go hand in hand with it as well, and you would carry on being a bit of a cheeky bugger in the afterlife.
Well, I'd certainly like to think so. It'd be really nice to think, wouldn't it, that you retain some characteristics, you retain something if there is an afterlife and if you are able to come back. So many of the stories that you get would tend to suggest that that's the case. You get other ones that suggest something entirely different, don't you? But there's certainly a wealth of evidence out there that does make that a distinct possibility.
Yeah, very much so. I think it would be remiss without touching on some of the wonderful personal encounters that you've included in your latest volume. So if that's all right with you, I shall start with a very interesting series of events that occurred with a lady called Harriet, who was based out in Anglesey in Wales, Ruth. And it's a very interesting collection of events that she's sent on to you, because the one thing that strikes me is, even though there are a variety of phenomenon that goes on through a considerable period of time, she's still quite positive despite the varying nature of the incidents that happened to her.
She is. And the other interesting part, I mean, I should say at this point that Harriet is a pseudonym, because I do use pseudonyms in the book unless somebody specifically asks me to put their real name in. But she moved in and out of this property several times over a number of, well, a couple of decades, actually. You know, at different parts of her life. It was a property that offered rented accommodation within it, sort of an old building. And, you know, at different parts of her life, she either visited it or rented space in it, or later on, you know, rented one particular area of it to bring her children up in. So she actually, knowing that there was haunting and the paranormal activity, she still chose to move in and out of the property, because she actually ended, when, you know, when I interviewed her and spoke with her, she actually ended by saying that despite everything, some of her fondest memories of her lifetime were with that property, you know, because it was such a lovely place to live, despite the fact that every now and again something weird would happen. So yeah, it just goes to show, doesn't it? There's a lot more depth to life than just one facet of something that's happening. You know, there were times there when it was unpleasant, but for the most part, it was a really lovely place to live and didn't feel bad for her.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very interesting point to the whole story as well, because, like you say, she found herself there as a young woman, and I think it was about 7 years later she ends up moving back there. And it seems in that time as well that whatever was there the first time round didn't seem to happen when she returned.
No, it was completely different things. Yeah, so when she was there the first time around, she was there with her... The first time she ever visited it, she just visited it as a sort of 16-year-old going to a party. But the second time she went there, she went to stay there for a while, which was about 3 or 4 years later, because she'd had her young child. They were struggling to find anywhere to live because she was a single parent at that point in her life. So she was renting a room, and she was actually using different rooms while she waited for a permanent room to become available. So she and her little lad were moving from room to room, you know, each night. And there was one particular night she was using a bedroom which had twin beds in it. And she settled her little son down to sleep in one of the beds. And then she must have fallen asleep quite quickly on the other bed, because she was actually woken by the sound of a man and woman arguing. And the pair were really going at it, shouting at each other. And of course, that itself didn't strike her as totally impossible, because she lived in a property with multiple rentings within it, so there were plenty of other people around that could have been having an argument. It wasn't as if she was in an empty property and thought, oh my god, you know, straight away that it was something paranormal. So she lay there for a moment listening to them really shouting at each other, and then began to worry that maybe it was the landlord of the property and his ex-wife, and that maybe this wife had turned up and was causing trouble. So she thought she'd go downstairs, you know, sort of on a pretext to get a drink or whatever, thinking that if they knew that they'd disturbed the tenants, it would kind of calm the situation down, if you know what I mean. So she went downstairs and opened the living room door where the shouting was coming from. And as she opened the door, the room suddenly was totally silent and in total darkness. So there was absolutely nobody about, nobody else up, nobody about. The shouting ceased instantly. So, of course, this did scare her a little bit. So off she went back up to bed, back to her room. But no sooner had she sort of settled back down again than the shouting started up again. And this time she could actually make out words from the man's voice that was shouting. And he was saying, "I'll never let you go, never." So being a bit more scared this time around, because she obviously already checked once and found there was nobody in the room downstairs, she actually ran to the landlord's room and woke him up and got him to sit with her. He didn't hear it at all and said that he'd lived there years and never seen or heard anything. So, but who knows? Who knows who that was?
Yeah.
It is very strange as well, like you say, because it disturbed her from being asleep, so it must have been quite audible.
Absolutely.
And it is one of those remarkable things, because you think, oh, you know, well, the last thing anybody's going to do is several years later, when they find themselves needing accommodation, you would think, well, why on earth would you go back there? But then, as we touched on, when she goes back, it seems to be a very different situation going on.
Yeah, so she went back there about 7 years after that. And by this time, she'd got a partner, and she now had a second child, and they were at a point in their life where they'd just sold a house, but it was in the 1990s. The housing market was in a lot of flux at that time, particularly in Wales. And so they were struggling to find somewhere else to buy, even though they'd just sold. So they came to an agreement with the landlord at Plas Ewchaf, where she'd stayed friends with him all these years, that they would rent the annex for, you know, a bit of a low rent in return for them revamping it a bit for him. So, you know, he'd let them rent it at a sort of peanut rent, and in return they'd do it up ready for him to, you know, rent it out properly, sort of thing. And that gave them both a solution, because that meant that they got somewhere to live quite cheaply while they looked around to buy, you know, their next home, sort of thing, without eating too far into their savings and what have you. And the landlord got the renovation done. So they moved back in, and she was really, really happy living there. She, you know, they started making the annex into a really lovely place, did a load of refurbishments of it. But she would still sometimes get some strange vibes around the place. You know, so, for example, one day she was working in her daughter's bedroom, you know, doing the housework, tidying up, putting clothes away, when there was a loud bang right next to her, like somebody just dropped a heavy object on the floor right next to her. So she jumped, and the family's pet dog, who was in the room, sort of startled and legged it. And she sort of thought, well, I don't know what that was, and just carried on. And then similarly, another day she was doing the housework, just finished hoovering, put the hoover away, went upstairs to the loo, came out just seconds later, and there's a trail of tiny nuts and bolts strewn all across the top of the landing, which she'd just hoovered. So she'd certainly have noticed them, because, well, you know yourself, when you're doing the hoovering, your focus is on the floor, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
You're moving the machine, and you're looking down at the floor. And not only that, but the hoover would have sucked them up.
Yeah.
So you'd have heard all these little nuts and bolts go rattling up the hoover had they been there. And she said they were like those tiny nuts and bolts that you get in a Meccano set. Except her children didn't own a Meccano set. So, you know, that's not what they were. She said it was just that's what they made her think of, the tiny little nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
So, and things like this just kept happening. She was in the kitchen one day, and she was going to feed the cat, make herself a cup of tea. She left the children playing in the living room. Her two children and the landlord's son had joined the kids. So she was opening the drawers, looking for the tin opener to open the cat food, when something banged immediately behind her again. Getting a bit more used now to the tricks this house would pull, she just ignored it, carried on searching through the doors, but it banged again as if to get her attention. So she turned around to look, and there's one of the cupboard doors swinging open. And that had obviously been that had banged itself shut. But right in front of it on the work surface was the tin opener that she'd been looking for. So, you know, it's almost like you say, that was almost a mischievous presence, possibly even a slightly helpful presence.
Yes.
And it didn't bother her. It didn't feel like any kind of threat or danger to her.
It is, like you say, it's one of those where it seems to enjoy keeping her on her toes, to say the least, because there is a remarkable incident where, I think there's a few of them, and a box from under the sink comes flying out.
Yeah, this was another evening when kids were all in, because you've got to remember, this is a large old property with different areas of it rented out, and so some areas were communal. And the big old kitchen was one of these areas that was communal. So one particular evening, she and her partner were sitting around the table there with several other people from around the property, sitting around chatting. One of the men was standing at the sink washing up, and was sort of joining in the conversation as well, chatting in. Below the sink, if you can imagine, it's like a sort of very old-fashioned kitchen, old-fashioned sink. Below it was an open shelving area with a sort of just a cloth over it, not an actual door. So it's like an open cupboard. And he stood there in front of the sink, washing away, and all of a sudden, a box came flying out from this cupboard area under his, in front of his legs, and shot about 6 foot out across the kitchen floor.
Mm.
Leaving the whole group to sort of stare at it in astonishment, because obviously there's no way that even if you imagine, well, could it have been a cat or rats or something in the cupboard? There's no way a small animal, even if that was the case, would have the strength to push a box in such a way that it skids 6 foot out across the floor. You know, tip a box over, maybe, so as it, you know, just tumbles slightly. Mm. That's possible. But not to push something out with such force that it goes skidding off across the kitchen floor. And it's funny because one of the lodgers often complained, one of the other lodgers often complained that he could hear clattering of pots and pans in the kitchen whenever he fell asleep, and he would keep going and finding it dark and empty. So, yeah, there was obviously, you know, a presence there.
Yeah. And it seems as though there were, I mean, my interpretation of it, Ruth, is that when I've read this recollection, it's almost as if there seems to be two different types, because there obviously there's this one in the house that seems to like pulling people's legs, and then obviously there's an incident towards the end where she's asked to look after another tenant's children, I believe, who are stopping in a caravan, which is slightly, you know, obviously outside in the grounds, and there's a bit of one of those things where you think, oh, like that, is it? But where she feels as though she's being quite threatened by something.
Yeah, she was sitting in the caravan with the children that she was babysitting asleep. And she'd left her own children asleep in the main house with the other adults around in there. So she was just sitting quietly playing the guitar. And she says she actually felt the change in the atmosphere, that it suddenly seemed to go sort of thick and cold in there, you know, like a pregnant sort of atmosphere, like something was about to happen. Sort of put the prickles up on her back of her neck, as it were. Yeah. And she felt something punch her quite hard in the side, yeah, like in her side, you know. So she tried to ignore it because, you know, by now she's used to living in this property and knows it plays some tricks.
Yeah.
Got up to put the kettle on, but something then punched her more strongly in the centre of her chest. So she did actually decide to go back into the main house, check on her own children, and then check back on the children in the caravan every 15 minutes,
yes,
rather than sit around waiting for this to happen. But interestingly, the next day her friend sort of said, oh, thanks for watching the children for me, you know, and said, I would have asked my own mum to do it, but my mum doesn't like staying in the caravan because she thinks there's a bad feeling in there.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, very true. And I know that there seems to be a couple of incidents, not just for Harriet, but also a previous family that had stayed in there, that seemed to have a rather worrying experience of choking at different periods.
Yeah, she did find this out later on, and this is nothing that they experienced themselves. They certainly didn't get this level of fear while she was there.
Mm.
But they were told that a family who'd lived there before them had a young girl staying, a little girl staying with them, and she'd found a necklace in the shape of a crucifix on a pendant laying about in the house, which this little girl took to wearing. And she'd actually woken in the middle of the night feeling that somebody was trying to strangle her using that pendant to you know, like a garrote to strangle her with. And apparently that family had left quite hurriedly because of that, probably not surprisingly, because I think that does feel quite threatening.
Yes.
And I can't help but wonder in my head whether that's link to the arguing man and woman that she'd heard years earlier.
Yeah.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And like I say, it seemed very odd because when you read something like this, there seems to be two very different types of hauntings. There's one that seems to be quite aggressive and we've, you know, we have physical assaults, even though they're fairly minor. And then the other one is just somebody that seems to be having a bit of fun.
Yes. Yeah. And she, I mean, Harriet says she, you know, over the years, she did, and not surprisingly really, living with this, she developed her own sensitivities to spirit.
Mm.
And that as she developed her sensitivity, she became aware that there was a ghost of a woman there in the house who was watching for her husband's ship because the house overlooked the bay.
Mm.
And her children would sometimes say that they'd seen a lady ghost. You know, which does tend to sort of bear that out a bit. So, I mean, our son saw that particularly when he was reading one day, sitting in bed reading, looked up, saw the lady, looked down again, thinking I'm imagining that. Looked up again, but she was still there. And she'd also heard, Harriet herself had also heard a child's voice at one occasion. And it came from her daughter's bedroom, and it was in the middle of the night when the two girls were asleep, because her daughter had a friend staying over, so there was two girls asleep in the room. And she could, as she walked past the bedroom, she actually heard a little girl sobbing, "I'm never going to get out of here." And she assumed it was the friend, sort of, you know, feeling homesick or whatever. So she sort of quietly opened the door, intending to go in and comfort and see if she was okay and what have you, only to find that both girls were fast asleep and nobody was crying, so she didn't know where that noise had come from. But it you know, it really was an incredibly active property, but over a period of a lot of years. And I think it's worth bearing that in mind, that there's a lot of period in between each of these where it was a very happy, warm place to live. So
yeah, and like you say, it is remarkable that despite all this, she's got very fond memories of her time there.
Yeah,
strangely leading on, obviously, that there are a few stories that always I'm always interested in whenever an animal's involved, because there's often this perception that on many occasions, Ruth, animals will sense things that their owners or ourselves can't, because we'll often see your pet dog or your pet cat suddenly start staring or looking at something walking through the room and there's nothing there, or the fur on their back stands up and they seem to be reacting to something that nobody else can see or sense. And there's a rather scary story in regards from a family in Birmingham who finally, after a considerable period of haunting going on in this property they were in, they decided that the best thing to do was leave after going out and leaving their dog in one particular room, returning to find it locked in a different room.
Yeah, I mean, that would freak you out, wouldn't it? I mean, obviously, the dog itself's got no way of opening and closing the rooms on its own. You would have to physically undo the doors and then shut them again. So, you know, this was a they bought the property on one of these sort of lease buy arrangements.
Yes.
So you had to live in it for so many years, and that there was financial penalty to pay if you left early and so on. Quite a modern house, so you wouldn't sort of immediately assume it might be haunted or anything. Quiet cul-de-sac. But by the time they'd lived in it for just 3 years, she says they were so terrified that they paid the early settlement fee to move out and get away rather than have to stay. Because she would say to her husband, "I'd rather go and live in a tent in the garden than stay in this house." and that gives you an indication of how desperate they were to get out of there. And they did try to find out whether there was any cause for the haunting, you know, any history, but all they could find out was that the plot of land would just been farmland prior to being developed into this quiet little suburban cul-de-sac. So that they just never did find anything to understand what or why it was haunted. But they would see a shadow man on the stairs. Strangely, whenever her mother saw it, the man was always wearing a hat. Yeah. But whenever her son saw it, the man was always without a hat. Which is curious, isn't it?
Yeah.
She herself once saw an apparition of a dog on the stairs, and she did wonder if that's why her own dog didn't seem to be particularly bothered by having the ghost in the thing.
Yeah.
And they would often hear the sound of marbles being rolled along the floor in her son's bedroom, which is quite a distinctive sound, as you know. And weirdly, just as we started talking about this, I could hear that here, in here. And I've been looking around me trying to see what rolled. So if anybody hears that on the recording, when you play this back, I don't know what that was rolling in here either. But they never did even figure that sound out, because the whole place was fitted with wall-to-wall carpet.
Yeah.
So there should never have been the sound of rolling marbles, paranormal or otherwise. They wouldn't make a sound if there were any marbles there. They often saw the doors opening and shutting. Sometimes the window in the front bedroom would open and shut itself. And like you say, they finally, she got to the point where she's that is it. No more, we're moving out, we're paying the fee, we're moving out, was when they got home, the dog was in the front parlour room, and they'd left it shut in the back room, and all the doors in between were still shut, so quite how that had occurred, but it was the final straw for her. You know, she sort of felt that it was interfering with their lives too much by that stage, and moved out.
Yeah, I think it gives it a real kind of resonance, that as well, Ruth, as you refer to, because they ended up being financially penalised for this. So this clearly wasn't someone trying to get out of something early or exaggerating something, because as you say, it cost them money to do what they did. And that, I think, for any family, kind of gives it a lot more credence than somebody going, "Oh, yeah, well, my house is haunted, I don't like living here." they were far happier just to pay up and go.
Yes. And it's curious, isn't it? Because if you read everything that happened at Plasutchaf, the place we were just talking about, and then everything that happened here at this Birmingham house, you would think that between the two, the Plasutchaf seems more active and more scary. And yet that person describes it as most of the time a comfortable and wonderful place to live with just occasional pockets of scary. Whereas the atmosphere in this house in Birmingham left them feeling constantly tense and nervous about what was happening. So that you've got this sort of, you know, over a period of 3 years, it becomes unbearable rather than something to just be curious about. And I think it's quite important to take note of that change in atmosphere for people. Whether that's a product of the atmosphere itself or whether that's the way the person perceives it, I don't suppose you would ever be able to measure, but it's interesting how, you know, two different reactions to reasonably similar, but one you would think of slightly less, if you like, haunting. But then I suppose really when you think about it, is that so unusual? I mean, I've got a friend of mine, we've been friends since we were wee tots, so she knew me when I was living in our most haunted property, and to this day she doesn't even like reading my books, let alone having me talk to her about ghosts or anything, because she finds the whole subject utterly terrifying. You know, so having to deal with it at all, even, you know, even in written format, not interested, doesn't want to know, too scary. Whereas, of course, other people like you and me utterly fascinated and will talk for hours about it, you know, try shut us up if you dare sort of thing. So is that more about the person's own natural reaction, or is it more about what kind of atmosphere the place was generating? And it'd be interesting to figure out a way how to measure that, but I'm afraid that'll have to be left for somebody cleverer than me.
Yes, very true. It is interesting how some people, I mean, I've heard numerous stories where often there will be a family and maybe the mother and the children will be experiencing something and the father will just poo-poo it until something happens that he can't sort of ignore anymore. And I often find that kind of attitude very odd, that some people will be so pig-headed about living in a haunted property that they will reach for the most ridiculous explanation to try and say, oh well, it's because this has happened that's caused that and that's why this is going on, rather than listening to the people that they live with and thinking, well, yeah, actually something's not quite right here.
Well, I sometimes wonder, because obviously I hear a lot of that with the research I do and the stories and what have you, and hundreds of stories that I've got either I've already published or that are in the database waiting to be published. And I often sometimes wonder whether it's not necessarily so much pig-headedness as fear. And that actually that person is like my friend, who would rather reach for any other explanation other than paranormal than have to face the fact that paranormal might actually exist, you know, that there might actually be things in this world that we can't account for.
I suspect that's as good an explanation, certainly better than mine. I think it is a lot to do with fear, Ruth.
I think with some people it is, you know, I think they, you know, that the fear keeps them from wanting to look. Other people, I suspect pig-headedness might come into it, but
yes. Horses for courses, no doubt.
Yes, no doubt.
Now, there is another remarkable collection of experiences in it, which is in Blandford Forum in Dorset. And I suspect that this is one of those collections that you weren't really prepared for what was going to happen, because this seems to be, when you start reading it, it's about a property that is now an estate agent's, and it's the usual, oh well, we've got people can hear footsteps upstairs and some people don't like going onto the top floor of this property. But it seems to be on a street and in an area where it's not the only place that strange things seem to be going on.
Well, do you know, this was one of those, like, it was like digging for opals, this. You know, you get that one little glimmer and then all of a sudden you come across a rich seam of it. And it, you know, it's the ghost hunter, ghost researcher's dream, this one was, because I started off with an account I found online about a haunting in a building in Blandford Forum, as you said, which at the time of the account was occupied by an estate agent and was on the market square in the town centre. Blandford Forum is a wonderfully picturesque little old town in south of the UK in Dorset. The estate agents occupied a much older building, could have been Georgian period probably. It's got a coach-sized covered entrance to the side, so it's quite possible at some point it might have been a coaching inn or something like that. But the lady who I'd found the account of said that when the building was occupied by her employer at the time, she and her colleagues had been sitting in a small room on the first floor when they would hear the sound of footsteps walking up the corridor and stop outside the door of the room they were occupying.
Mm.
And if they checked to get up and see who it was, nobody there. No visitors, nobody around.
Mm.
So, and this had happened on a couple of occasions, and one of her colleagues had said that whilst they were using the loo one day in the building, somebody had knocked on the toilet stall's door. But again, there was nobody actually in the loos at the time.
Mm.
So, of course, this is the kind of small nugget that I start off with when I'm doing my research. And I did what I normally do, which is I went out on social media for the local area, for Blandford, Forn, for Dorset. And I asked anybody, had they got any hauntings, property around Market Square, Blandford, Forn. Now, I'm always really careful when I go out and make these requests to not ask specifically for what it is I'm looking for two reasons. One, I don't want people to try and tailor what they think they've heard or seen to what they think I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So I want them to give me their unadulterated, straight from the heart, first-hand accounts of something they've experienced. And I also don't want to put somebody else off who thinks, oh, well, she's asking about the estate agents on Market Square, but my experience was in the sweet shop next door or whatever. So I won't bother writing to her because that's not what she's looking for.
Mm.
So I want to leave it open for anybody to write in. And at the same time, I don't want to influence my witnesses into tailoring that, you know, subconsciously or otherwise, tailoring what they think I want to hear.
Yes.
So, of course, I just asked for local information about haunting in that area, and I got a wealth of replies. It was amazing. Honestly, they're coming in thick and fast, faster than I could keep up. So I had one lady who said she worked at a shop just two doors down, which is what she told me. I worked it out from the description.
Mm.
So she was telling me about a shop that's two doors down from this estate agent, and they were always convinced that that shop was haunted by the ghost of a little girl. But now that she thought about it, writing to me to tell me about it, she couldn't really remember or work out what it was that made them think it was a little girl.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, they always used to refer to this visitor as Matilda. Another lady wrote in and said she'd worked in a shop on, you know, on Market Square, and by describing it, it was obvious that she'd been in the estate agent, but she'd retired in 2008, so some years earlier, and when she worked there, they all thought it was very creepy on the upper floors, so again, you know, we're back upstairs, and during her time, they all thought it was an old lady, for some reason, again.
Mm.
They too would hear footsteps walking up and down along these upper floors, and doors up there would randomly open and close. And one of her colleagues felt a distinct tap on her shoulder. This particular witness said she personally doesn't believe in, has no interest in the paranormal, but couldn't help feeling there was something inexplicable going on in there, and she was just responding because she'd seen my request. Then another gentleman contacted me to say he didn't know anything about Market Square, but his granddad used to own a shop just down Salisbury Street, which is literally just round the corner, as it were, and that building was haunted, and that they would often hear footsteps tramping up and down the stairs. apparently, his own granddad has been the man who owned this shop, who obviously now is since deceased and so on, who died in 1963. He's now been seen as a ghost back into his own house, rather than the property owned as a commercial property.
Mm.
So then we had another lady write into me, say she worked in a building which I worked out was at the other end of Market Square, and they also had problems with activity in the upstairs parts of the building. So they'd set out articles ready for finishing the next day, and when they came back in the morning, things would be moved around. Now, interestingly, they called in a medium to ask, you know, because they sort of thought, we've got something going on here.
Yeah.
And that medium told them that they picked up on a young lady, so a young girl perhaps, in a white dress, who the medium referred to as Martha.
Mm.
Now, bear in mind, the earlier had somehow named their ghost Matilda. I can't help but think, I wonder if this is all connected, you know, because Martha, Matilda, they're often shortenings of one another, you know, in English language sort of thing. And all these properties that, you know, there were several more, all seem to be on the upstairs levels of these floors. And then somebody wrote to me and said, Oh, well, you do know that the whole of Blandford Forum town centre was destroyed by a fire in 1731, don't you? And I was like, no, I didn't know that. So, of course, I researched that, and looked up and said, yeah, absolutely. Apparently, the fire was so vicious. I mean, obviously, in 1731, an awful lot of wooden buildings, awful lot of very old buildings, everything was... It went up like an absolute conflagration, you know. And in one of the pubs along there, people have often woken up saying that they've had bad dreams where they felt like they were burning, and you can't help but wonder if this kind of plethora of paranormal activity has somehow found its link from this horrible fire in 1731, because apparently it was so bad that it was described as a firestorm, and it actually boiled the lead off the church roof, and people were running to avoid the molten metal. But it didn't actually kill a huge number of people, only 12 people, which, considering how bad it was, is really quite low. It's a town memory. You can understand how that might sort of echo down the ages as a paranormal echo, almost, if you like, or even have sparked one of the spirits to hang around. You know, perhaps this Martha, Matilda, whatever she was related with that.
Yeah, it is striking, as you refer to there, Ruth, that there seems to be a lot of properties in this very close area that seem to all be experiencing the same kind of phenomenon, because often it's very rare you'll hear of two properties in close proximity to each other that are haunted, never mind half a dozen. And for them to all sort of have weird footsteps going on, things moving around. I know one property has the classic things turning themselves on and off and things like that. And then you add in the fact that some people called it Matilda and some people called it Martha. It really does seem like it's the same thing in a variety of locations. It seems a little bit too coincidental.
It does, really. It really struck me as there's some kind of connection here, because all of them are talking about it being in their upstairs parts of their buildings. You know, it's in the upper floors. Well, historically, you know, when you look at a lot of the very old English market towns like Blandford Forum, a lot of the buildings in the town go back to the 1700s, 1600s, whatever. And very often the upstairs parts of the buildings are quite unused and very often untouched. So you will often find that, you know, if you go upstairs in some of these, what on the ground floor might be a modern shop or whatever, but at the further up in the building you go, the less and less modernised they become, because over the years, you know, different shops have moved in and out of the premises, and they obviously only spend as much money as they need to for their commercial purposes, you know, which makes you wonder whether what you've got here is one of those kind of perfect storms of something big that happened in the town that affected all these properties, and so that when the properties are rebuilt, or, you know, what's left of them is rebuilt, whatever, you've ended up with quite a lot of ancient parts that are all still there, and that somehow this has, you know, become a bit of a paranormal magnet somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm like I say, my job is to research it and write it down, not figure out how.
Yeah, it is peculiar, because there are very few areas of the United Kingdom where you have a situation like this. I know last time we spoke, we both couldn't remember Pluckley off the top of our heads.
That drove us nuts last time, didn't it?
It did. We got there in the end, and I got an email from somebody saying I was shouting Pluckley at the as you were talking about it, and I thought, yeah,
I can imagine. Yeah.
But this seems to be a similar situation where there's a lot going on in a very small area, and it's highly unusual in my personal experience. And I know, obviously, Ruth, is probably a lot fresher in your mind because, you know, this is what you're involved in and love doing at the current time. So were you surprised to come across something like this? Because it does seem quite remarkable in this day and age to come across a situation like this.
Well, I'm getting a bit more used to it, I think is probably the truth, because I've now got, you know, if you read all five books, if you're brave enough, go on, read all five.
Yeah.
You'll notice that there are several instances, with the probable exception of Almanac of British Ghosts, which is a different type of book. But in the others, there are several instances of patches or little conglomerations, if you like, of paranormal activity in one cluster. So thinking off the top of my head, you know, and forgive me, people, I know you'd think I would know all the content, but when you've done as much research as I have and written about it so extensively, honestly, it goes out of your head.
We'll let you off.
Particularly when you have a head like mine, like a sieve. But, you know, just off the top of my head, I think of places like Risley in Bedfordshire, that has so many different accounts of some kind of equine ghost. There's a village in Kent. Now, was it Great Wavering, something like that? Where I had loads and loads. It was very similar to this in Blandford Forum, where loads and loads of people had responded with properties all around the high street that had paranormal activity. There's, in this actual current book, Haunted Times Volume 2, there's a Turvey in Bedfordshire, where a whole load of properties in one close all had things going on. So I think it happens more often than we realise. But the trouble that we've got is that there aren't very many people like me around anymore who are gathering it and linking it together. So unless somebody provides that forum for people to link the stories, it's quite easy. If you could imagine, you know, these people that from Blandford Forum that were writing to me, if I hadn't written that post, they would have gone their whole lives not knowing that somebody two doors down was also experiencing something. You'd have no reason to go knocking on the doors round where you are. By the way, have you got a ghost as well? that just doesn't happen, does it? Whereas when you've got somebody like me who's gathering it all together and sticking it in a database and looking for the correlations and then recording them, I think that's beginning to pick up more and more and more of these, you know?
Yeah, and I think the other aspect of this is, as we've touched on at the beginning of our conversation, Ruth, these aren't the frightening stories. These aren't the scary ones. These are footsteps, knockings, occasional glances of something out of the corner of your eye. These are not what is deemed as the sellable version of the paranormal that we find ourselves immersed in these days across all forms of entertainment. And I think a lot of people would ignore these kind of situations because they're not that exciting in their opinion.
Yeah, and I actually think that's to the detriment of research on the paranormal. You know, from my experience, the majority of paranormal things that happen to people are these mundane, every day, slips in and out of normal everyday happening, can happen to anybody, any time of day or night. You don't have to be doing a sort of Blair Witch Project, filming at dead of night, you know, with Yvette Fielding screaming in the background or whatever. You don't need that kind of level of hyped up for something paranormal to happen. Mm. It can happen any time to anybody. And actually, I think that's the reality of the paranormal for the most part. I'm not saying there aren't times when you get the really, really high end, if you like.
Yes.
But there's a whole range below that, isn't there? From tiny little happenings to sort of, you know, places like this where you get a real pocket of, although each individual happening is small, you know, set of footsteps, a door opens, somebody gets a tap on the shoulder. If taken individually, tiny, but put it together in the picture of a whole town centre where a number of the properties are experiencing it, and bearing in mind, you know, you've then got to factor in, these are only the people that responded that saw my request. How many other hundreds and hundreds of people have worked or lived around that town centre over the decades who never saw my request and therefore never answered? You know, there must be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, mustn't there? And how many of them, had I got a way of tracking them down or whatever and asking, would say, well, yeah, actually, you know, blah 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 happened. So it's being aware that you can only ever touch the tip of the iceberg, but at least, and this is why I get so excited when people do write into me, and please, 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 people listening, write in, however small you think your story is, write in, because you don't know whether I've already got an entry for that place on my database. My database is mahoosive. Well, it is. I've been gathering it for 30 years. The poor thing's creaking at the seams, honestly. And, you know, I can check instantly whether I've got anything else in that location. And it might be, because that's kind of how my mind works, a bit like a forensic police mind, that one little chip of information that you give might just slot in and help form the picture of a wider paranormal picture that's gathering for that area.
Mm. Yeah.
See, you get me all excited and off I go.
Well, I think that's a fair point, and it is a very interesting thing. It's one of those things, I think, Ruth, that a lot of people arrogantly presume everybody's on social media. Everybody sees everything that's done there, and I think that's a prime example of that, that there must be countless, like you say, especially when it's a retail situation, how many hundreds of people will have passed through that location over the years?
Yes. And it would never occur to them to look on the social media for that area. Mm. You know, they were never part of that social media, or they're a person who doesn't deal with social media, or they deal with a different social media platform than I deal with. You know, there's all these variables built in, isn't there? And I mean, a lot of people don't have any interest in social media, full stop.
Yeah.
So they're never ever going to see my requests at all.
Mm.
And yet, you know, they may well have a piece of the puzzle, sort of thing. You know, and there's only so many ways you can reach out, really, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
And try and get the information. And, you know, I repeat the call whenever I can through media like yourselves here. People write in, because it's that linking together of information that just endlessly fascinates me, honestly.
Mm.
I get so excited if somebody sends me a little snippet and I can link it to a snippet already on my database. It's like going gold hunting, it really is.
Yeah, well, I think as we've calmed everybody down and we've said things aren't too scary, I think one of the entries in the book, which I found both particularly creepy, and it's also opened up a whole realm of possibilities to me, and we were speaking about this before we started our proper conversation, is the entry that's in regards to Her Majesty's Prison in Lewes, because prison ghosts, especially in the UK, are something that I can think of virtually no stories in regards to this particular facet of the paranormal, Ruth. And yet you've got this incredible entry that seems to have gone on for quite a while, which opens up a whole new realm of hauntings in the United Kingdom, and that's haunted prisons.
Absolutely, and you're right, this one is quite creepy, really. This was actually, it was a gentleman who wrote to me, and he used to work as a prison guard, ward, or whatever you call them, at HMP Lewes, or Lewes, however you say it. And he wrote with, you know, the various things he'd noticed while he was working there. So he'd told me that at the time that he was there, there was different wings to the prison, and they had names, as in one was F wing, one was D wing, whatever it might be. So And each prison officer worked different shifts. So you would work sometimes day shifts, sometimes night shifts. If you were on the night shift, it went from 8:30 in the evening till 7 o'clock the next morning. And he was telling me that what was called F-Wing in the prison was one of the oldest parts of the actual building. And some parts of it date back to Victorian times. So the F-Wing has a ground floor, first floor, top floor. Mm. And for some reasons, they're referred to as levels 2, 3 and 4. Don't know why, they just are. And each floor has a metre wide walkway running around the inner edge, looking down on the central ground floor area. So if you imagine anybody standing in that central ground floor area looking up can see all three floors all the way up to the ceiling with these walkways going round. So it was easy for any person walking on the gantries to call out to one another from any floor, if you see what I mean, because there's this central shaft, if you see what I mean. And it was part of their job that on taking up duty on their shift, each officer had to do a prison account for their bit that they were in charge of. And that meant going around every single cell, looking through the hatch and checking that the right number of occupants were inside and checking the door was properly locked. And that made that there's no sort of slipping through the net, you know, a la the Great Escape style, between the handover from day shift to night shift, where day shift thinks, oh, well, we know that, you know, Fred Bloggs has got to go back to his cell, and night shift doesn't notice that Fred Bloggs hasn't gone back to his cell.
Mm.
It stops that happening. The night shift officer at that time, I don't know whether they still do or don't, but at that time when he worked there, didn't carry any keys because the prisoners would stay in their cells throughout the night. They didn't come in and out of the cells.
Mm.
So once he'd done his walk round and checked that the right number of prisoners were in the right cells and all the locks had been checked, then the night shift officer would officially take over the floor and the day shift officers could go on home. So this particular night, my chap was working as night shift officer, had performed all of these functions and gone to sit in the office. Now, at this time, they happened to have a male, because this was an all-male prisoners' cell, prison, I should say, at this time. So they happened to have a prisoner who had very long blonde hair, and his cell was on the ground level, which was on the level they called two, so that it was called as being in the twos. So he sat there fiddling with his paperwork, and he notices somebody with long blonde hair walk past the office window, the internal window of the office. So he immediately informs the officer in charge that they've got a prisoner out of the cell, because he assumes it's this one prisoner they've got that's got the long blonde hair, and goes waiting for the officer in charge to arrive, who's got the keys, and the two of them then start, you know, the pre-prescribed check to go and find this prisoner that he'd just seen walk across. So, of course, they went straight to the one that he thought it was, the one with the long blonde hair, but the door was securely locked, and they could see him asleep inside when they checked through the hatch. So they then did a methodical check of every cell door, every floor, checking to see if somebody, you know, was it someone else, somebody, you know, and you just mistaken the hair or whatever. And while my correspondent was on the second level, which they called the threes, he heard somebody walking on the gantry above him. So he shouted down to the officer in charge, "He's up there on the fours." So the officer in charge headed up the stairs, and he saw a figure on that top floor and raced after it. But he met with my correspondent a few minutes later and said to him, "I cornered it, and it was there in front of me as plain as anything. It was definitely a woman, but as I got near it just faded away." And that officer in charge didn't ever want to work the night shift again. It had frightened him so badly. And of course he got quite a bit of ribbing, because people thought he'd only made the story up to get out of having to do night shifts.
Yes.
but like, yeah, exactly. But my correspondent said, but you know, he was there. He knew he'd seen somebody walk past the office. You know, so he knew that it was very likely that this second officer had in fact cornered the, you know, apparition, whatever it was, you know, and seen it, sort of thing. So that was the sort of first incident.
Yeah.
And he admits that he did do his best to avoid doing night shifts himself. Inevitably, you know, he did have to. So he was on night shift. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he got a radio message through that the officer in charge wanted him to bring the security department camera.
Yeah.
Now, apparently, mobile phones, cameras, or phones with cameras aren't allowed in prisons. So, you know, there's this one camera that is the security department camera, and it's kept under lock and key. And when he joined the officer in charge, what it was that we're looking at and wanted to photograph was, apparently there's a walkway leading from where the wings of the prison are to where the visiting areas of the prisons are, which has a bit of a dubious roof. So it's quite often got a wet floor. There's, you know, puddles of water left standing on the parquet floor.
Yeah.
This particular night it was raining. The floor was damp in places because of this dodgy roof, and the officer in charge wanted to get a photograph because there was a barefoot footprint of a small size, maybe a child's, like a four-year-old child size, on that parquet floor in a prison that A, is only adult men, and B, everybody is locked up in their cells all night and nobody can move around, and the prison officers are sure as hell not walking around barefoot.
Yeah.
And he wanted to photograph it to document, look, you know, it's really there. Creepy. And I must admit, you know, it begs the thought in me, you and I were saying before we came on air tonight, the thought of being shut in a prison is bad enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the thought of being shut in there with a possible ghost and no choice but to be in this small room with a locked door, if yours happened to be the room that the blooming ghost visited or walked past or whatever every night. I mean, that is the stuff of nightmares, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially those guys who are stuck on the fourth floor with this, wherever this female ghost goes wandering about. It would be remarkable to see or find out. I mean, it might be one of those things, Ruth, where it's one of those stories that once it comes out, you may get more stories, because it would be very interesting to see if any of the inmates could shed any light, or previous inmates would be able to shed. Have they had any experiences? Because the remarkable thing about all of these aspects of this particular report in the book is that these are all serving prison officers and wardens and members of staff.
Yes. So we haven't heard anything from the people that are actually trying to get sleep in these rooms. You know, while this, I mean, were they aware it was going on? Who knows? I don't know. But it, I mean, it would be absolutely fascinating if, you know, to find out, and to find out whether there's any other prisons.
Yeah.
That have any sort of activity, you know. Yeah. Doesn't bear thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, you would imagine, because some of the prisons in the United Kingdom are extremely old and have simply just been updated and modernised as they've gone on. I know we've had a few that have been built over recent years, Ruth, but a lot of them date back to the 18th and 19th century here in the UK.
A lot of them, you know, really do go back quite some time, don't they? And, you know, like you say, the buildings have been modernised in most cases, but there are still parts of the building, particularly the sort of structural parts, that are still the, you know, Victorian or even earlier. You know, so why not have a haunting? But then again, even with a modern building, you know, as we spoke about just earlier this evening, you know, a perfectly modern built, you know, house in a modern cul-de-sac with no particular history can pick up a haunting, so who knows?
Yeah, and obviously the other aspect of prisons is some of them have some very unusual inmates. You know, these are certain prisons in the United Kingdom. I'm thinking, you know, Broadmoor is a prime example. Wakefield is known as a Category A prison because of the prisoners that are kept there and the crimes they've committed. And a lot of them are there for the rest of their lives, Ruth. So where would they go once they pass away?
And as well, there must be an awful lot of very heightened emotions within a prison, mustn't there?
Absolutely.
You know, because guilty or otherwise, nevertheless, you know, there must be a certain amount of horror with being locked up for, you know, either a large number of years, or in some cases the rest of your life. That must carry with it a certain amount of mental anguish and heightened, you know, emotional response, mustn't it? And a lot of paranormal theories assume that heightened emotional response will often imprint on an area and cause paranormal activity. So to me, it's almost logical that a prison would be quite a hotbed for paranormal stuff, much like you would expect hospitals are as well.
Yes.
And we do get a fair few stories come through from hospitals, but not as many as you'd think. And I certainly don't get given as many as you'd think. And what I tend to find is that nurses, doctors, whatever, are loath to speak about it because I don't quite know whether they would feel it kind of cheapens what they do by kind of sensationalising somehow what's happening within a hospital. They certainly wouldn't want people trying to do paranormal investigations whilst they were trying to, you know, treat people and what have you. So does that preclude people wanting to talk about what might be happening? And it might be the same with prisons. You know, do prison officers not want to share? Because again, they, you know, you couldn't really cope with people trying to investigate a prison, could you?
No.
You know, not one that was in use. If you've got an abandoned prison or, you know, a no longer in use, maybe, you know, I mean, Bodmin Jail springs to mind, doesn't it?
Yes.
Know?
Yeah.
Was a prison in the day, isn't now, has got a museum in it, it, you know, is and about to open a new hotel in it, so I'm told. Which you can go and stay in.
Yes.
You know, that's always been known to have a lot of, you know, paranormal activity in it. So, but yes, whether a, you know, an active prison or an active hospital would actually share its stories, who knows? Yeah.
I mean, that is something else. And once again, it is a strange facet of British paranormal history that we don't seem to have very many stories about hospitals or prisons. It's all over here, whereas certain countries, you know, America and Canada especially, I'm thinking, you know, I've seen series about haunted hospitals based out there. So it is interesting how it seems to be something that, like you say, does it degrade the medical staff's experience, and they're rather loath to I don't know, how they see it as maybe trivialising what may have happened, because obviously a lot of times you're dealing with people spending their last moments on Earth in hospitals, sadly. So maybe there's a bit of that to it as well, Ruth, I suspect.
Yeah, a bit of personal respect. Or maybe it's sort of something to do with the British psyche that, you know, we don't talk about that.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, the British stiff upper lip sort of thing.
Mm.
That's behind the closed doors of the hospital or the prison or the school even. I mean, I must admit, I think there is definitely an element of that, because I sometimes get stories sent to me about when somebody worked at a particular school or, you know, particular boarding schools or whatever that were much older buildings. And I hand on heart will hold my hand up and say, I've never followed them up with the school, because I make the assumption that the school would not want their school associated with anything paranormal because they've got children. So I kind of make a conscious effort to not follow those up on that assumption. And I wonder if that same assumption kind of permeates throughout the prison world and the hospital world and so on, that these, you know, institution type places don't talk about the paranormal happenings they have in them.
Yeah. I mean, especially with schools as well, because some of them will be obviously of a religious denomination, and it may not be encouraged to be open and honest about the paranormal, depending on which particular denomination they are.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And also, some of them are still, you know, some of the ones that I've got on my database are still currently private schools, you know, privately funded schools. And I would imagine, you know, they wouldn't really want that being discussed in case parents didn't want to send their children there.
Yes.
And, you know, they lost them revenue sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are other aspects to that, aren't there, that, you know, you sort of think, well, is that why we don't get many? It's not that it's not happening, it's that it's not talked about, which is a different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, because often it, for pubs and hotels, it's a real selling point, but clearly for boarding schools, it's not encouraged to advertise that if you send your children here, they may be haunted.
Yes. Yes, it's perhaps something you wouldn't want to put on the school curriculum, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think keeping with that stiff upper lip approach, there's another wonderful story. But this is one of those that made me smile, because it's that kind of story that someone finds themselves in a situation and has to deal with something, and when they report what happens to them, it's like, yeah, another one on the list. And that's the ghost at RAF Upwood, who certainly seems to like terrorising new recruits.
Yes, or newly married ones, anyway. so this story dates back to 1974, and was a chap that wrote to me, you know, having read some of the books and listened to some of my interviews and what have you. And he told me about his time when he was serving in the RAF, and he was posted to RAF Wyton. Now, at that time, in the early 1970s, RAF Wyton didn't have much in the way to offer of married quarters, so he and his new wife were offered a house at RAF Upwood, which was nearby. So although he was based at Wyton, they were going to be living at RAF Upwood. So they moved in, everything fine, settled into his new duty, family settled in, so on. But after a while, they realised that their two-year-old son, whenever he had a bad night and, you know, wouldn't settle and what have you, he would consistently complain about the man in his bedroom. And they dismissed this at first, slightly odd, nothing of anything significant though, you know, child being a child sort of thing. But then one night, they were both, him and his wife, both asleep in bed, and they suddenly woke up simultaneously and sort of thought, what just disturbed us, you know? So they were trying to work out why they'd both just woken up, and they were saying to each other, good grief, it seems cold in here, when a grey figure wearing some sort of hooded garment, so maybe a monk type garment perhaps, suddenly walked through the room and straight through the wall next to the bed where they shared a wall with the adjacent house. So of course they're just absolutely astonished. They've got out of bed, they're talking about it, they're trying to rationalise what on earth they've just experienced, when they hear pounding on their front door. They rush down to answer the front door, and there's their next door neighbour from the house that they're joined onto, where this figure has just walked through the wall. And the neighbour had just been woken up, so, you know, their neighbour, RAF officer, who's in the next house, because obviously these are RAF houses, was woken up by the figure walking through his wall from their side, and then walking across his bedroom. So then, now you've got the two households wide awake, where this blooming figure has walked through one bedroom, through the intervening wall, and through the next. So they decided that, seeing as they could back each other up and report that, that would give them the backup to be able to report it to their powers that be in the RAF, because both wives in particular were like, well, I don't want to stay here. You could be out on deployment for weeks at end and I'm alone in that bedroom with a flipping ghost walking through it, thank you very much. So the next day the two men went to the family's office to say, look, we're really not happy, you know, can you move us? And they were expecting to have to sort of put up a bit of a fight to get moved, and that they were going to back each other up, and you know, they're all sort of primed and ready. But much to their surprise, the family's officer sort of sighed, opened the filing cabinet and said, right, I was expecting this, when do you want to move out, lads? Because apparently every family that had moved in there had reported the same problem, you know, that this figure was known to walk through these two properties, and the family's officer was just used to, yeah, so it's fine, I'll move you. So he did. He did actually do some research, my correspondence, and he said that part of the airbase apparently used to belong to Ramsey Abbey, nearby Ramsey Abbey, and that there had originally been monastic buildings on that site. So it is entirely possible it was actually the ghost of a monk that they saw walking. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've always had a thing, because one of my favourite ghost stories in the UK is the infamous haunting of Bertram Newton Air Base, which was in Norfolk, which is extremely famous due to the recordings that were made, I think they were in the 1970s, Ruth, in the squash courts, where two guys thought they'd try and prove that nothing was going on, and they said, oh, we were going to stay in there all night, and I think after half an hour they thought, bugger this, and just left the recorder running, and then they just captured some really, really strange sounds throughout the night. So air bases are another kind of place where you think, because of the emotional imprints of what's gone on through their history over the last 100 years, for me, it's one of those places where, not that I'm being facetious, but I would expect a haunting to occur because of what's gone on, and the fact that for a lot of these places, they would have seen some of its staff unfortunately pass away in the course of duty.
Yes, and, you know, as part of war, and, you know, and therefore the heightened thing. I actually cover Bertram Newton in These Haunted Times Volume 1, and there's quite a lot of updated, you know, people who have written into me with things that they experienced there, as well as that original count of the recordings. So yeah, it's, I think it's still quite an active site, Bertram Newton.
Yeah, because I remember that, I think one of the things that really kicked it off was there was somebody was filming a documentary or something, and there was some air people mucking about in the background, and he's, oh, you've ruined my shot, and he went over to tell them off and they just vanished before his eyes.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And he realised that he'd actually managed to be half filming some ghosts.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one of the ladies who wrote to me, I was just scanning back and having a look, she moved into a house that's on the edge of the what was the site of Bertram Newton, and had hauntings there in sort of 2013. A lot more modern sort of thing. So it's a site that's retained its paranormal activity for, well, quite some decades now, Bertram Newton.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's one of those key parts, because there are numerous stories up and down the UK. Biggin Hill is another one where there are even reports of ghostly spitfires, which is, once again, one of those more unusual ones. I think when you have a mode of transport involved, Ruth, that seems to give the story a whole new complexity that you don't normally get with a haunting, because you just usually assume it's some kind of disembodied person or even an animal, rather than, you know, a piece of machinery.
You do, but then I point you towards my book Roadmap of British Ghosts, which has all sorts of lorries and cars and planes and coaches and horses and coaches and carts and you name it, haunting our roads up and down the country. It'd be amazing what you accidentally almost crash into on our roads. And actually, Biggin Hill even makes an appearance in Almanac of British Ghosts.
Yes.
Because on January the 19th, every year, you're meant to be able to hear the sound of a World War One aircraft approaching the air, you know, the old airfield, and that's supposed to happen every January the 19th. So last night, in fact.
Yeah.
So if anybody, you know, around where Biggin Hill used to be, you know, the old part of Biggin Hill, last night heard a Merlin engine Spitfire type plane, you were quite possibly hearing the cyclical ghost of Biggin Hill.
Yeah, Yeah. Yeah, fantastic.
And this is one of the things that my husband hates about me, because wherever we go, I'll point to somewhere and go, that road's haunted, that house is haunted, that pub is haunted, that church is supposed to have a ghost. And he said, oh, will you shut up?
Yeah, where you should just be driving over the fields. Avoiding everywhere, Ruth.
Avoiding everywhere. Well, like my poor sister, who is a nurse herself and works in a hospital and has to drive home through country lanes late at night after strange shifts, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm forever gleefully finding ghosts that are near where she has to drive. She hates me.
Yeah. And I think the final thing I'll touch on, Ruth, is... it's obviously in this book, and I know we mentioned it last time because you were discussing your own personal experience, but obviously I think ironically that the area is called North Crawley, which would often, you would expect something to be not quite right around there, but your personal experience I still find very remarkable, because as you've shown in your previous books and your current one, Ruth, you will actually go to places to check, to dig into these stories, to look at the actual history, to find out if there are any truth in that, and it's not just a friend of a friend of a friend said, oh, I've seen this once, and there's absolutely no evidence, or as you touched on in the almanac, there's a lot of these ghosts that are supposed to appear at certain times of the year, but nobody's seen them for decades.
Yes, or there's no record of anybody ever actually seeing them.
Yes.
But, and North Crawley, I will hold my hand up. I am still too scared to drive down that stretch of road on my own at night, having seen the figure I saw down there. And bear in mind that, you know, generally, I deliberately go to places all times of day and night. Those that have been ghost hunting with me will know that I will happily go into a darkened room and sit there on my own in pitch black, waiting for something to happen, you know, and trying to record it and what have you. And yet somehow this particular apparition that I saw in North Crawley, or just outside North Crawley, just leaves me creeped out beyond all belief. I cannot bring myself to go there on my own. I could do it if somebody's in the car with me, and I can do it during the day on my own, but not at night. I can't. And I've found that if I dwell on it too much, I'll actually get myself creeped out and left feeling all nervous here at home, sort of thing, because it's only a few miles up the road from me where it is. And it's bizarre because, like you say, nothing else has freaked me to the extent that one did. But there was something about, and it's even more bizarre because the figure wasn't even looking my way. It was facing away from me, you know, so you couldn't say that it gave me a, you know, terrifying look or anything, because it was facing away from me. But there was just something about it that absolutely put my hackles up somehow. And curiously, since you and I spoke last time, one of my friends here in the village had listened to you and I speaking, and she messaged me afterwards and said, oh, go on, tell me which road is this I've got to avoid round here now, you know. So she said, where in North Crawley? So I explained exactly where I'd seen it. And she said, oh, that's really weird. That's the bit of road we used to call the creepy road when I was a kid. I said, why did you call it the creepy road? And she said, well, because for some reason, whenever we drove past it at night, we used to shut our eyes because it was too creepy to look at. Well, that's bizarre, isn't it? Still generates a reaction, even though they never actually saw anything and never actually experienced anything, but a little bit of that fear it generated in me has been generated in other people as well. So yeah, there's something about that bit.
Yeah. Do you think it's because it caught you unawares, Ruth, that it's had this effect?
No, honestly, I don't, because there's been plenty of times that I've been caught unawares by something paranormal, and it'll intrigue me, and it might give me a bit of a start. It might even freak me out for a day or two a bit, something. But it doesn't stick with me the way this has.
Yeah.
So, don't know. I can't explain what it is about that's different, but there's something about that particular area. I've met my nemesis.
Yeah, I mean, I know when you recount it, there's clearly, as you touch on there, it's stuck with you, and it seems to me that it was the feeling coupled with the sighting that probably done this.
It was something about the feeling that it generated. You know, the figure itself was odd looking, sure. You know, with being, because you probably remember when I spoke before about the way it was kind of looked like it was camouflaged with the colours of that night. And so the sort of like glittery frost colour, the grey of the mist and the black of the night, all patchworked all over it. So it certainly was weird looking, but that isn't what makes me feel creepy when I think about the way it looked. It's just the figure somehow. There was it kind of emanated some kind of feeling of threat, or I wouldn't go so far as to say danger, but some kind of like morose threat somehow. You know, like a depressing sort of a threat about it somehow. So yeah, absolutely creeped the heck out of me, and I'll hold my hand up to that. I am the world's worst ghost hunter. I will not go back to find it. Anybody who's braver, I do know a couple of ghost hunters that have gone to check for me, and they've driven up and down and up and down it, that stretch of road, and they haven't managed to see anything. But on one trip down it, they both felt something cold pass through the car that made them both shiver in unison, sort of thing, you know. So who knows? By all means, people, get out there and try and tell me what it is.
Go and do it on your behalf, Ruth.
It's the one place that, despite lockdown, I'm very pleased that I can't go to anymore.
Well, I think finally I'll just touch on a couple of other things. I mean, what I've often found interesting, and it was quite peculiar, this. I was reading an article the other day that was going on about why do we never get stories of phantom hitchhikers anymore? And I was thinking, well, it all depends on what you consider a hitchhiker, because once again, in this book, there are several stories from people, more than one person, driving in a car on a patch of road that encounters something that terrifies them all. And I know when we spoke originally, you just got that report from that group of young lads who were so scared that the driver couldn't actually talk to you about what had happened to him. So do you find that it's interesting that we don't seem to get as many hitchhiker stories, or that we still seem to get these creepy ghosts just floating across roads sometimes?
I think roads are amongst the most active, paranormally speaking, places, just from the number of accounts I get from people. So much so, I'm seriously considering doing a roadmap volume 2, Roadmap of British Ghosts volume 2, because I've got that many. And yes, you know, the classic hitchhiker story, I mean, is it Stanbridge in Bedfordshire, is the most classic that Arthur C. Clarke investigated. You know, but there's dozens up and down the country of the hitchhiker that gets in the car and asks to be taken to a certain location. When they get there, they've disappeared, but it turns out that the daughter or son or whatever it was had died years before, and it's their ghost trying to get home. They appear up and down the country in urban myth all over the place. You can't ever find anybody that actually experienced that, but you can often find people who in that location saw a figure on the road. So I suspect that the phantom hitchhiker as an urban myth is losing popularity, but it hasn't stopped the fact that the phantoms on the side of the roads that caused the myth in the first place are still there and still very active. And I think that's what's actually happening. I think the urban myth around it is changing with time, but I think the actual apparitions on the roads are still just as active as they ever were, not more so.
Absolutely. So, I mean, because is it Roy Fulton, the famous one?
Yes, that's it. Yes, that's the name. Van Driver.
Because we were talking about this, strangely, on the 40 and Times Facebook page, and I always said, this is the gold standard hitchhiker story for me, because he's either the world's greatest actor or it happened to him.
Yes.
And I think he did. And it always makes me laugh, because he always says it scared him that much he had to drive to the pub and have a double brandy. Because that's how you dealt with things like that in the 1970s.
Yes. Perfectly legitimate response.
But it always reminds me as well, there was a TV show in the 90s shown over here, which was called Strange But True, which was presented by Michael Aspel. You might remember it, Ruth.
Yes, yeah.
And they once did a very interesting section, because it always used to be two parts, and one part would do one story, and the second part would obviously do a second one. And they once did one about, not necessarily a hitchhiking ghost, but there was a stretch of road in South Africa where the police had actually been involved in an incident where car doors were opening on somebody's car, and the police thought this guy was winding them up, and they went back with him and saw the car doors opening on their own as they drove through this stretch of road, which is one of those stories that I think just people seem to have completely forgotten that one. And that I think, was occurring sort of in the 80s.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? That's reminiscent of that road in America where, I can't for the life of me remember where it is now that I've mentioned it, but there's a pond next to the road where somebody is meant to have drowned. And if you say her name 3 times, she interferes with your car.
Mm.
And there's a video that you can watch online of some people doing that. And the car is parked down the road away from them. And they specifically put the keys to the car on the bonnet to show that they're not tampering with the car or doing it with the keys or anything.
Mm.
And as they're sort of trying to provoke this spirit in this pond, the car alarm starts going off.
Oh.
And then the battery goes on it. The battery goes dead on the car. So, yeah, I mean, you know, quite a global phenomena, isn't it?
It is.
Ghosts on highways and roads.
It is. And it is interesting. Strangely enough, I was watching another show, Expedition X, which is presented by Josh Gates, and he sends a couple of people to various locations, clearly because obviously Josh is too busy to do it himself at the minute. And one of them involved, and it's one of those stories where you think, well, hang on a minute, that doesn't really ring true, because unfortunately two women were driving home one night in the 1950s. Their car careered off the road into this lake, which was a man-made lake, I believe it is. I've forgotten where it was now. And the car wasn't, they weren't discovered for ages. And one of the bodies, I think, didn't turn up for a year. And that's one of those stories where we're told that something forced them off the road and they crashed. But both people in the car died instantly. So how do we know something forced them off the road?
Well, it's funny that this week, my job this week has been, I've been revising Almanac of British Ghosts.
Mm.
Simply because somebody had said it would be better if there was an index of the places as well as the dates. It's great. And it's a good time to clear up any little discrepancies and spelling mistakes. So, and several times in that, I've pointed out, how can we possibly know this? Because everybody died.
Yes.
If everybody died, how do we know that that's what happened? Because there's these wonderful lurid tales about, you know, they were on the deck of the boat, or, you know, they were on the bridge struggling to death, and a ghost rose out of the water and dragged one screaming to hell, and the other one, you know, died of shock. Well, then how do you know that happened if everybody was dead? There was nobody left alive to tell us, you know? Which does, of course, then tend to make you think, well, that's a made-up story or an urban myth or whatever then behind that,
Absolutely. Well, that one I was referring to there in the States is peculiar as well, because it's one of those where there's graveyards in this lake that have just been left.
Wow.
And they were saying, oh, it's an urban myth, it's not true. So they actually went in the lake with, like, a dive team, and they were there. The gravestones were still on the lake floor, and they so the authorities had told everybody they'd removed all the gravestones and graves and reinterned them somewhere else, and they hadn't. They were there, clear as day, on the bottom of this lake.
And therefore, you know, does that mean that the rest of the tales about hauntings around it also had some validity? Well, makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It does, because a lot of them are saying they see something coming out of the water. So, and
there's something particularly creepy about ghosts around water, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it's that kind of old folk tale about being tempted into it, isn't it? I think whether it's to do with mermaids and mermen or things like that, Ruth, there seems to be a real danger associated with any spirit that's connected with water in some way, I suspect.
Yes, there's an extra level of specific harm intended by the spirit when it's by water, isn't there, for some reason?
Yeah. Well, I think that'll help everybody sleep well, and I think that's a good part to leave it, Ruth, as we send everybody to bed with some nightmares. So, firstly, thank you so much for coming back. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you again.
You're very welcome. You know how I always love to come and talk about ghosts.
Oh, yes. It's one of those wonderfully easy conversations when I have you as a guest, Ruth. So thank you. So what's happening now? Obviously, you've touched on there that you're revising the Almanac, which as we mentioned last time, I mean I like all your books, but I did particularly like that one because it was interesting to see other areas of the country that do have these anniversary ghosts. So what have you got planned next? I know you're still being inundated with reports and encounters from people. So where are you going next with it?
Well, I promised myself, because that, you know, anybody that's been following my work knows that I published my first one a little under 4 years ago and have published five books in that time, which, as you can imagine, you know, has been quite intense going to stick out five books in 4 years. And the downside of that is that my database has gotten extremely messy. My office has gotten extremely messy with all the books on ghosts and goodness and what. So I promised myself that this time I was going to clean up the databases, put everything back into a tidy order, re-edit the five books that are out for any, you know, little changes that need to be done, and then start on a new project. And so far I've been really good. I published Haunted Times Volume 2 just end of November or mid-November, and I have cleaned up the databases. They're now good to go, and I've cleaned up the office, and I'm now editing. I've done Ghost of Marston Vale, I've nearly done Almanac, so I'm going to re-edit the other three next, and then I'm going to make a decision on what book number six is actually going to cover, because I'm back at one of those points where, because of the people writing in, which is brilliant, keep doing it people, my database is again bursting at the seams with stories that I haven't yet published. So it's a case of how am I going to split that into something that, you know, into a theme that makes sense. Do I do a Haunted Times Volume 3? Do I do a Roadmap of Fish Ghosts Volume 3? Or do I do a different, you know, format completely, like Haunted Churches or Haunted Pubs or something? I don't know. So honestly, right now, I'm at a juncture where I'm thinking, after I've done this bit, I'll sit down and decide what the next project's going to be. And I have a horrible feeling, knowing me, that it'll end up being two projects at once. I can't put it down. I just get fascinated. Because I've got a bit of a hankering to do something other than UK ghosts as well. I might do some American research next, maybe. We'll see. Watch this space. There will be something, because you know me, can't stop.
Fabulous. Well, if anybody's got an experience that they need to share with you, Ruth, what's the best way to get hold of you?
If you could email me at wa-1400@outlook.com, or connect to me via Twitter or Facebook, just look for Ruth Roper Wild.
Fabulous. And all the books are available via Amazon?
They're all through Amazon primarily, but there are quite a lot of other online sellers sell them as well. You know, if you prefer other formats, they are available as ebook or paperback. And if you happen to have a Kindle Unlimited subscription, you can read them for free.
Fabulous. Well, once again, thank you again for your wonderful company and chilling stories that you've shared with us this evening. It's been a real pleasure to have you back, Ruth. And I look forward to the next time we can have a conversation.
Brilliant. Speak to you soon, hopefully.